Annabeth Noel, now 21 months old, and in possession of, she's got to be pushing 400 words now. I mean, like 3 weeks ago, now make that 2 weeks ago now, she was at, well, I've logged 300 and what was it, 36 or 37 or 38 actual words or phrases that were in her possession as of 2 weeks ago. And now, and of course, there's a whole bunch that I didn't get because I gave up after 21 months trying to keep track of this kind of stuff. You know, even a proud dad has his limits, right? And the next couple days, she was spouting words and phrases with such expertise, I know they were in her arsenal during that 21-month period, but I didn't get them on the sheet. So, and now she's gone way past that. And especially last evening, the first time my daughter said, "Stand to reason." So cool. My wife said, "We got to get that on tape," because she said it kind of like, "Stand to reason." She got a little rise at the end there, so it was kind of a joyful, playful way of saying it. Now, she doesn't have the foggiest idea what "stand to reason" means. We're trying to associate that phrase with the question, "Where does Papa work?" Stand to reason. But she doesn't know what work is. So even if she knows how to say the sound "stand to reason," after she hears the sound "where does Papa work," it'll be a long time before she understands that. But it was sweet getting her to say it. Well, we didn't even try. All of it, she heard me say it, and then she started saying it. And then on the way back home from an event we went to last evening, she was chanting it in the back seat. "Stand to reason, stand to reason, stand to reason." I guess that's the way to learn. You know, you just kind of repetition. And even though she doesn't know what it means, she will shortly, before too long. She'll figure that out. But it was sweet. And we will get that on tape, and we'll probably build it into our introduction right after, where the guy says, "What I hate is a smart aleck kid," and then we'll hear "stand to reason." 1-800-227-5278 if you'd like to talk with me. Two things came up this week that I noticed in one page of letters to the editor from the LA Times. And I used to read these on a regular basis. It turned out that I just couldn't bear it anymore. And who was it? Was it Andrew Weil? You know, that kind of wild-haired, misty-eyed, glowing, new-age medical guy? I don't follow him either, but he did make a comment that I think is right. He said, "Don't read the newspaper. It only makes you angry." Well, he's right. I mean, that was a good thing. It was kind of a series of recommendations that he made to have a happier life. Quit reading the paper. Don't watch the news. Well, you need to be informed. Well, first of all, it presumes that the newspaper and the nightly news inform you, which isn't always the case. But secondly, do you really need to be informed with the kind of information that you usually get on the nightly news? Probably not. And so I was reading, but the LA Times, you know, you got to do it a lot once in a while, and I do receive it. So every once in a while I take a look at the op-eds, and most of the time it just annoys me. It ruins my day, so I throw it out, and I try to forget I ever read it. And that's true with most newspapers. But every once in a while you get a pulse of the culture. You get an idea of what people are complaining about, what concerns them, their point of view. Now, last week I was talking about how I started out talking about a kind of a trend. And I spoke of this last night at the banquet I was at for Brett Kunkel, one of our speakers, that, you know, Jesus talked about reading the weather and knowing the signs of the times. And so I kind of gave a weather report, and I talked about the things I talked about with you at the beginning of last week's show, that is Andrew Sullivan's article about the danger of religion, particularly Christian religion, those people who think they're right. And this was a mounting trend, as I cited Bill Maher and Rosie O'Donnell, and there's actually more things since then. And so there is this trend of public sentiment against evangelicals who are characterized as the right-wing fundamentalists, without really a historical perspective that pretty much evangelicals have been running things, or at least our point of view has been running things for the last 200 years. And as Dennis Prager pointed out, it just has brought liberty and freedom, not the kind of oppression that you see in the doomsday scenarios painted by those who fear the religious right more than they fear Muslim terrorists. Now, to me, this is significant that people would say this in this regard. It is so utterly outlandish that it smacks to me of kind of spiritual warfare. And here I'm speaking to insiders who are followers of Christ. You know what it says in Ephesians chapter 6, where the Apostle Paul says that we battle not against flesh and blood. I mean, we have conflicts with individual people. Flesh and blood was a New Testament term that meant simply human beings. Our battle isn't really against the face-to-face encounters that we're having with other people. I mean, that's where we live immediately, but that's not what it's really about, Paul says. He says there's a spiritual battle in the heavenly places. There's a conflict of spiritual powers that is real and significant and determinative of many of the things that we face in our culture. There's something going on behind the scenes, and what you see with your physical eyes is just the ramifications of that. And so as a follower of Christ and what the New Testament says about the way the world is, I take Paul's observation seriously. And when bizarre things happen, like evangelical Christians are more feared by many in this country than Muslim terrorists, I mean, that's silly. Then I wonder, where is this coming from? Why would somebody believe that? And see, this just strikes me as evidence of a power that's behind the human being. I mean, the human beings on their own wouldn't be that dumb. But they're getting a little help, a little encouragement, I think, from the spiritual realm to say these silly things and even believe these silly things. So last week I talked about that, about this trend that is very real and palpable, this fear that people have of you and I if you're a follower of Jesus and you're serious about it. I guess that's a nice way of saying fundamentalist. Though strictly speaking, I wouldn't call myself a fundamentalist. As an evangelical, many others would call me a fundamentalist. But all that means is we take seriously the point of view and the writings and the teachings of our founder, or founders, I should say, because it's not just Jesus, but those whom Jesus trained to take his message to the world. And they are the authors of the New Testament, who collected Jesus' saying. So we take those things seriously. So, and if you're those kind of people, then you're dangerous. And there's another thing that I saw this week. It's all to lead up to this observation. In reading the LA Times, a series of responses to an article which I didn't read, though it would have been fun, it had to do with whether fish can feel pain. Now, many of you know that I love fishing. Doesn't mean I do it very much. I'm working a lot. But I do enjoy fishing, and I take a couple, 2 or 3 weeks in the early summer and go to our cabin in Wisconsin, and I practice catch and release. That means I catch them and I let them go. That's why I'm not a hunter. It doesn't work. But in fishing, it works. You just take the hook out and put them back in the water. And I'm very careful. I don't touch their scales and get their slime off so they don't get sick after they're gone. And I'm very, very careful. But a lot of people don't like this because fish feel pain in the process, and it is unconscionable to follow a sport in which terrorizes creatures like this. That's the way some people think. Well, I appreciate their point of view. The problem is their reason for their point of view. There has been some research that shows that fish don't feel that much pain. Their brains are too small to process much, and that's certainly true of most smaller creatures. They just don't have the hardware to be able to process much actual pain where higher primates like us, we've got complicated machinery that can process all kinds of pain and pleasure, both physical and emotional. So apparently there was an article that came out in the opinion section, October 8th, called Hooked on a Myth. And apparently a new study, fish feels pain. Well, it kind of depends where you poke them. Now, most fish are caught in the mouth. And if you're a fisherman, you know when you hook a fish in the mouth, it doesn't bleed there because it's just cartilage. It doesn't have blood in there. It's kind of like it's more like a fingernail. And I've noticed this, by the way, when I hook a fish and I can see it in clear water, I hook it in the mouth, in the lip. And they'll sometimes, it's like they tug their head a little bit and knock their head sideways and like, what is that thing that's pulling on my lip? it isn't a response of pain. It's just a response of surprise because something's holding them that they didn't have there before. And then after a little while, they'll get a little more frantic, and then they start pulling really hard when they realize that something's dragging them away, this invisible line attached to the hook in their lip. But it's not the pain. Now, it might be if they swallow the hook that they can feel that pain. But, you know, they have new circle hooks, right? A circle hook doesn't even stick in the fish. It goes into their mouth, and as you pull on your rod to tighten the line, it slides out of their mouth and goes around their lip and hooks like a latch on the outside of their lip, so it doesn't even stick them. So I'm not too concerned about the pain in the fish, personally. However, here's what some people have said as they read this piece, Hooked on a Myth. I come unglued every time I hear about researchers still testing animals to see if they feel pain. Of course, this isn't animals. This is fish. There's a difference. In this day and age, any moron should know that all living creatures with a brain and a central nervous system feel pain. And yes, they experience many emotions similar to those of humans. Now, I don't know how they know that, that all living things experience emotions the same way that humans do. How would they know that? Do you think an ant is worrying about where he's going to get his next meal? I don't know. But this is part of a trend, and you're going to see the idea at the heart of the trend in a moment. I continue. They have social structures. These are the animals that feel pain and experience emotions. They have social structures and varying degrees of cognitive thinking levels similar to those of humans. Now, they do have varying degrees of cognitive thinking levels. That, like, there are some that are smarter than others. This seems to be obvious, but what do you mean similar to those of humans? Animals don't survive much by thinking. Most of them survive by instinct, not by thinking, by instinctively doing things, not by thinking it through. But notice the trend. Well, you're going to see the point in just a second. Here it comes. We are all, pardon me, we are all animals, just different species. This is not rocket science and certainly does not warrant any more time, money, or effort to test or prove. Well, this is the point here. We are all animals. I mentioned last week a trend to think of Christians as dangerous. This is another trend. That trend is to think as human beings as mere animals. And so when you try to make distinctions between humans and animals, of course, this is a mistake. Now, ladies and gentlemen, this is deeply confused. Yes, human beings have an animal nature, and they feel pain, and they think, and they have cognitive functions, and other creatures, in a way proportionate to the kind of creature they are, may feel pain and have some cognitive activity, but it's not the same. Just because we share creaturely habits or functions doesn't mean we're the same as those creatures and nothing more. Indeed, if we were nothing more, then why raise any objection whatsoever how we treat other animals? Those other animals aren't concerned about how they treat us. Do you see, when people raise these objections, inherent in the objection itself is the acknowledgement that we're different, that we're not just animals. We are moral creatures. That's different. And that has nothing to do with anything physical, because morals aren't physical things. They don't extend in space. They don't have weight. They don't have chemical properties. They don't respond to the laws of physics. And that's not rocket science. That anyone would think that we are just like animals and then say in the next breath that we have moral obligations that the animals don't have shows that these folks are not thinking very carefully. They're denying the obvious. We are different. This is why we gas termites and not human beings. But Jeanette Farrow of Baker, Los Angeles, Baker, Louisiana, rather, whose piece I just read, apparently doesn't get it. She's not the only one, though. Finally, researchers are investigating pain in other species. Those people who think it's sport to catch a fish and throw them back, that would be me, because they're not killing fish, should reconsider their actions. Pardon me. She continues. By the way, it's a she. The first one's a she. This is a she. Oh, the last one is a guy, so I guess it's not a woman thing. All right. She continues. I look forward to the day when more humans recognize that we are animals just like every other animal on this planet. Why would a person look forward to the day when everybody is convinced that we're mere animals? Because if we are animals, it's okay to act like animals. And animals do some pretty gruesome things for sport. We are just animals, just like every other animal on this planet, and we do not corner the market on suffering. Well, that's true. They don't corner the market on suffering, but hardly the point. Okay, last one here. Tim Martin of Corona. People who say fish don't feel pain are either mentally disemboweled or morally dishonest. If yelling ow is the criterion, then mutes don't feel pain. Well, I'm with him on that. If being too small to count is the key, then professional basketball players can eat the rest of us. Well, I'm with him on that. Although that's not the argument. The argument is fish in certain areas of their face and mouth do not feel pain because there's no pain nerves there or their brains can't process it in any event. I wonder if this guy's a pro-lifer, because this is the very argument that we use against the claim that the unborn are not human beings because they're too small. If being too small to count is the key, then professional basketball players can eat the rest of us. If common sense is worth anything, this debate is over. All living beings feel pain. Really? How about your petunia? Only arrogant humans feel that they are somehow entitled to ignore this simple fact. Notice here the theme also, again, this is a speciesism. See, we are human beings. We are just one of many species. We're no better than anybody else. But we feel arrogant in thinking we are better, and we can disregard the others. Notice the theme here. This is not a healthy trend, by the way. When people can't wait for the day when others believe that human beings are just animals, this is not a good trend. Because it's on the basis of the fact that we are not animals, that we are not merely animals, that we don't act like them, and we encourage other people not to act like animals because we are different. As I've said in the past, the argument for some human behavior that it's natural is not going to work, because the difference between just doing what comes naturally and principled self-restraint is one of the things that separates us from all other living creatures, and it makes possible what is called civilization. 1-800-227-5278. I'm Greg Kokel, and this is Stand to Reason.
I have a suggestion for you. Pick up the phone and dial 1-800-2-REASON. That's Stand to Reason's toll-free number. Ask us to send you solid ground, then leave your name and address. It's that simple. Let me tell you what this is for. If you call us, we're going to send you our bi-monthly publication, Solid Ground, free for a year. This is no ordinary newsletter. You'll receive practical, concise, useful tools to be an ambassador for Christ. In Solid Ground, Greg Kokel will help you deal with issues like abortion, evolution, cloning, homosexuality, doctor-assisted suicide, something timely so you're not caught by surprise and embarrassed when you want to stand up as an ambassador on key issues you will be challenged on. So call us right now at 1-800-2-REASON and ask for Solid Ground. We'll send it to you absolutely free. Or go to our website at str.org and ask for Solid Ground. While you're at it, you can download some of the over 300 free reports you'll also find there. That's 1-800-2-REASON and on the web, str.org.
In 1859, Charles Darwin published On the Origin of the Species and argued that all of life on Earth was the product of time, chance, and natural selection. However, contemporary scientists are advancing a powerful but controversial idea, the theory of intelligent design. Using state-of-the-art computer animation, the Unlocking the Mystery of Life DVD transports you into the interior of the living cell to explore systems that bear the unmistakable hallmarks of design. This compelling documentary examines an idea with the power to revolutionize our understanding of life and to unlock the mystery of its origin. Unlocking the Mystery of Life. To order this riveting DVD, call 1-800-2-REASON or go to our website, str.org. That's 1-800-2-REASON or str.org.
anticipation, don't be slow. Greg Kokel back with you here on Stand to Reason, and a couple of quick announcements before we get rolling. Stand to Reason is looking for a part-time warehouse assistant. That would be 20 hours a week, and if you go to like college somewhere around Long Beach or within striking distance, that's perfect, because we can work hours around your schedule oftentimes. The goal here is to assemble product, pack products for events, that kind of thing. If you would like to be considered for that that opening, send an email to tina@str.org as soon as possible. Send a resume or a description of your capabilities and your interest, and we'll get back to you. tina@str.org for part-time warehouse assistant at Stand to Reason. Also coming up this next weekend, that'll be Saturday night and two services on Sunday morning. I'll be in the San Clemente area at Pacific Coast Church. I've been there a number of times, have really enjoyed that group. I'll be talking about truth and faith. Truth is not ice cream. Faith is not wishing. That'll be at the 5 p.m. service on Saturday and then Sunday at 9 and 10:45. Here's the contact number, 949-940-2600. So it's the 949 area code, 940-2600. Of course, you can always go to our website at str.org and punch my face, and then you'll see a link for my schedule, and go to that, and you can get the details there as well. All right, to the phones and to Fort Wayne, Indiana, and Ryan. Ryan, Greg Kokel, thank you for calling.
Hey, Greg, how are you?
Good, thank you.
Hey, I just got done fishing a little bit ago.
You did? Oh, man, I'm envious. Where were you fishing?
We have a little pond here.
Oh, man.
My house. And
that's the most fun, those little ponds.
I came up empty today. So.
Oh, you did? Well, what do you usually catch there?
We got some pretty good-sized bass.
No kidding.
They don't grow that big up here in Indiana. They, you know, usually get about 3 or 4 pounds.
Oh, that's sweet, though. Those are fun.
Yeah, I mean, that's a nice day. But.
Oh, man.
But I didn't inflict any pain today because I didn't catch any.
Okay. By the way, have you noticed this? When you hook a fish, I don't know if you could how clear the water is, but when you hook them in the lip, how sometimes they're not freaky at first because they don't know what's going on? Have you ever noticed that?
No, I guess I've never noticed that.
Well, you watch for that, especially if you're worming. So if you set the hook on a fish and you're worming, you know, you hook them in the lip there. And you see them, they'll shake their head a little bit, like, what's that? What's tugging them? What is that? And then they start freaking out. So it's the panic. It's not the pain, I think, that makes the difference.
I gotcha.
All righty. What's on your mind today,
good
Ryan?
Night. Hey, I'm having a hard time reasoning out a situation. And, of course, I figured I would call you because I really appreciate your work and your teaching. And I really consider it an honor to call in today and
thank you.
Talk to you. But the issue is with Christians and antidepressant medication.
Mm-hmm.
I currently do not take an antidepressant. My wife does, but it seems like a lot of times when you talk to the Christian about antidepressant medications, how best do you say it? There's a stigma.
Okay.
You get a lot of
sure.
It doesn't always assume, but most of the time it connotates or assumes sin or just a natural stigma. And I just was wanting to know, is there any scriptures that you know of or how you could help me reason this out with some of my Christian friends to make this a little bit more crystal clear?
Well, it seems to me the scriptures need to be on their side. What they're suggesting by their conduct or their conversation is that depression, well, I guess it's coming from the perspective that depression is a sin, okay? And therefore, if you are depressed, you're in a sinful condition, and the way to deal with a sinful condition is not through medication but through repentance. I mean, they couldn't say that the medication itself is wrong.
Sure.
I mean, that would be odd.
Right.
I mean, I don't know of any Christian – well, I shouldn't say I don't know of any because there's a lot of weird ones out there I've been exposed to. But by and large, I haven't heard the argument that it's wrong to take medicine to medicate a problem.
Right.
I think they're going to argue that the real problem here is that you're depressed and you shouldn't be. And that ought to cheer you up here and that. You know, do you ever see that Monty Python skit where there was a guy who was, he was depressed. And so this was the happy nation or the happy country and everybody always had to be happy. And so they're laughing during the whole trial because everybody's putting on the laughing happy face. And then finally they find him guilty. He said, well, what happened? Ha, ha, ha. Well, my wife and children all died. And then everybody starts laughing because they all have to be happy. And then say, okay, you shall be hung by the neck until you cheer up. You know, that's the sentence.
Right.
Well, that's sometimes the way it is with Christians. Oh, you're depressed? Well, let me – let me give you some more to be depressed about. Naughty, naughty. You shouldn't be that way. You should be happy like me. Well, that's silly. It's like, this is why Monty Python got so much distance out of that skit. You should be hung by the neck until you cheer up. So is that what they suggest? No, you should trust God. Well, see, here's where I'm going to ask them to give me a biblical reference that makes it really clear that whenever a person is depressed, that it's a sin to be repented of. And then exactly how does one repent from the sin of depression? I'm not sure exactly how that works. Another thing, you know, sometimes, and I've done this in the past, but I got so angry once by someone who pressed this issue. You reach over their shoulder, and you know that trapezius muscle that your teacher used to grab when you were a naughty kid?
Oh, yeah.
You pinch it real hard until they're squirming. And then when they're squirming, they said, what are you doing? Cut that out. I said, no, I just want you to trust God through this. Don't ask me to stop doing what causes the pain. That's not spiritual. What you ought to do is smile and say everything's fine and trust God. See, depression is a physical pain, and it has a lot of different sources. Sometimes it's emotional, but it's not always emotional. A lot of times it's physical, and sometimes it starts out emotional and it ends up physical because your emotional state of affairs has a strong influence on your body chemistry, and then you can't get out of it because your chemistry is working against you. I have members of my own family that have confronted this. In fact, gee, I think the majority members of my own family have had to deal with depression in the past and had to be medicated at some point or another, and the medication rescued them. Now, why would anyone want to say that medicating clinical depression is immoral or wrong, for goodness sake? They wouldn't say the same thing about a broken arm.
Right. Well, the gentleman that I spoke with, actually, he takes, it's kind of odd, and I did use the Columbo tactic, essentially asking him the same thing, because he's on antihypertensive medication.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah, and it just, you know, so I said it seems to me that if a Christian cannot use an antidepressant, then they should not be able to use any type of medication.
Yeah, and arguably his situation, high blood pressure, right? Isn't that hypertension?
Yes.
Yeah, high blood pressure is at least in principle, or in many cases, you can do something about it by deciding to do things differently.
Right. There's a lot of correlations between, you know, obviously, I'm in the medical field. I'm a pharmaceutical
scientist. Okay. Well, so you know all about it.
And, you know, you talk about the serotonin and the epinephrine and the hormones. And then, you know, obviously there's a correlation, too, with the hypertension as well, that there is a hormone that they're actually trying to block.
Okay.
So there is.
But you can do dietary changes, too, that can help that.
My argument was to him and after thinking about it, was there's things that obviously stress in his life maybe that, you know, not that I would ever turn this around on him.
Right.
That if he's not dealing with certain things in his life, that can then lead to hypertension.
So of course, why is
he commit suicide?
Why is he? Why isn't he as charitable to others as he is to himself in situations like this?
Yeah.
And this is where I think the dictum, you know, we should love others as we love ourselves, or we should do unto others as we would have them do unto us, really has very practical application. There is no good argument that depression per se is a sin.
Right.
Now, it may be that sometimes we're gloomy for the wrong reasons, and we got to have an attitude check.
Right.
I acknowledge that. That certainly could be in the mix. But it isn't depression per se. Like, you're depressed? Huh. Wow. You repent.
Right.
You know, some people suffer very serious losses in their lives, and these losses drive them right to the bottom, and they don't know how to get out. And they trust the Lord, and they love the Lord, and all that other stuff. But look at, you know, trusting God's not magic. All discipline for the moment seems not to be joyful, but sorrowful.
Right.
Hebrews chapter 12. When you're in it, oh, man, this is hard. Even if God is the one who's authored this or allowed this to happen for your benefit, it's still hard. And to act like this is just an act of sin because you're feeling the way you're feeling, and if you're just like me, then you'd be happy all the time.
Right.
I mean, that's cruel. Francis Schaeffer put it this way, and this is something worth remembering. I reflect on it. I probably don't reflect on it as often as I need to, but since I border on being a perfectionist, it's something I have to keep in my mind. Mm-hmm. Here's what he said. All utopian ideals end up being cruel in the end because they can never be fulfilled. Those are true for spiritual utopian ideals as well.
Right.
I see no good reason not to be medicated when medication requires it, even for something like or when the circumstances require it, even for something like depression. Incidentally, we had J.P. Moreland on the show here a number of months ago. He's written a new book entitled The Lost Virtue of Happiness.
Mm-hmm.
It's worth reading.
Okay.
He has a whole chapter dedicated to his bout with depression.
I thought I heard you speak on that before, that he did have that situation in his life.
Right, and he took advantage of medication to help get a leg up on the process.
Right.
So when people start giving you a hard time, you just grab that muscle.
Right.
You know, right there. You know how to do that. You just let them have it.
Is there any
unless they're really, really big.
Am I over my time limit here?
No, that's right. But unless they're really, really big. I mean, the basic rule is if you can't reach it, you don't pinch it, you know?
I saw that.
All right. Go ahead.
Is there any indication of an elder being an elder in the church who's teaching the word that argument that I've heard as well is that a person who is an elder, and this is probably already answered my question, that a person who is an elder cannot be on an antidepressant as well because they are to be, you know, clear-minded and sober-minded.
Okay.
That argument, this once again falls on its face.
Well, the Bible doesn't say it's clear. They have to be clear-minded or sober-minded, but they mean, yeah. If you're on drugs and you're walking around like a drug zombie, it's going to be hard to do anything, intelligible,
right.
All right? So, but I don't think that's the case. Generally, what happens, and you know this better than anybody, people get on the right antidepressant medication, and what happens? They become better functioning. That's the point.
And unfortunately, it does usually take two or three, four tries at it before they find the right one.
Right, you know, because these are patient-specific and individual chemistry-specific kind of things. So,
okay.
Does that help?
Yes, it does, and I'll listen back to it on my MP3 and continue to work at that.
Well, I hope that is an encouragement to you, Ryan, and to your wife as well. Thanks.
Yep. Thanks, Greg.
Okay, bye-bye. This is one of those things that nearly gets my blood boiling because there are so many people that are already suffering severely, and there is no good reason to overcomplicate the suffering they're already experiencing by laying a spiritual trip on them. So the view that all depression is sin is seriously mistaken. And in fact, there are many depressed people in the Bible. You know, you go to Elijah, 1 Kings 19, 18, right in there. Elijah has this great spiritual victory. And then who is Jezebel gets mad at him. Now, Jezebel's this heathen queen. Well, she's the queen of Israel, but she's still a heathen. And she gets mad, and she said, well, I'm going to get you because you just killed all my prophets, 700 of them. I can see why she'd be mad. But here he goes from this great victory where God demonstrates his power there and then goes to utter defeat, and he makes a trek all the way to Sinai, and he's super depressed. Now, how does God deal with him? 1 Kings 19, you can read about it. Now, this is the passage where you hear the famous quote from the still small voice. Keep in mind that there is no still small voice in the sense that people usually mean it, like a little nudge in your heart. You say, oh, you know how God speaks to you in that still small voice. In this case, it was a still small voice. And why was he speaking to him quietly? It's because he was depressed. Bad. God doesn't upbraid him for being depressed. He does upbraid him a little bit for losing hope when, in fact, there are thousands of people that still have not bowed their knee to Baal, 7,000 to be exact, there in Israel. People that were a kindred spirit to Elijah, though Elijah felt all by himself. But God speaks to him quietly and encourages him. You know, he doesn't tell him, quit sinning and snap out of it, and you shall be hung by the neck until you cheer up. All right, let's go to Peter in the UK. Peter, welcome to Stand to Reason. Where in the UK are you?
I'm based in Romford in Essex.
Okay.
Okay, hello, Greg.
Yes, sir. Glad to talk to you.
How are you doing?
For calling. Good, thank you.
Yeah, I've been listening to your program for about 3 months now.
Good.
Yeah.
Glad to have you on board.
Yeah. I'm calling because about a couple of weeks ago, my pastor taught along the line that if somebody offends you and the person doesn't repent of what he or she has offended you about, you don't have to forgive them. And my question is, how can you not forgive someone and love them at the same time?
Well, I actually think this is a complicated question, and I've done some thinking about this. And part of the reason it's complicated is because we get a couple of different indications in the scriptures about forgiveness. There are some cases where it says just forgive. In other cases in the Gospels, when Jesus is speaking, and they even seem to be maybe a parallel accounts, we get a little more information. It says, if a person comes to you and asks for forgiveness, then you forgive. And so the forgiveness is a response to a request. Now, this seems to be very similar to what God does with us as well. That is, somebody come and we come and we repent, we have a change of mind, we ask before God for him to cleanse us from our sins, and it's at that point that God responds with forgiveness. He doesn't just forgive everyone in a blanket way, because if that were the case, then everyone would be saved. Everyone would go to heaven. Universalism would be true. Now, to the specifics of your question, how can we love them and not forgive them? I think God's an example of someone who loves us or loves human beings and doesn't always forgive human beings because they don't fulfill the requirements for forgiveness. So I think that it's possible to love and not forgive at the same time, because forgiveness means to release someone of a debt, okay? And it's possible, I think, to say, well, I love you, but I'm not going to release you of this debt. And love doesn't always require releasing of the debt, or else God would have, out of his love, would have to release everyone of their debts to him and therefore save all, regardless of their state of repentance.
Yeah, but wouldn't that be transferring the nature of God to man?
Well, remember the question, it's a fair response, but keep in mind the question. The question is it possible to love and not forgive at the same time? And my response is, well, it is possible because God seems to do that. Now, it may be that God can do something we can't do, but I don't know why that would be the case in this example. What is it about God that makes it possible for him to love and not forgive that somehow eludes us? I think we could be loving towards someone and have a loving attitude, but say, you know, you have to pay for what you did. We can't let you off on this one. I can imagine a parent facing a child and a child has done something wrong. And the child says, okay, I know I did something wrong. And the parent says, you know, I love you, but I can't let you off here. You're going to be punished for this. I'm not going to forgive you. You're going to be punished. You see, when you forgive, you release a person from punishment. When you punish, you're not forgiving. They're paying, they're not being released. So every time you punish a child, that is an example of lack of forgiveness. I don't think a parent is obliged to forgive every single time a child does something wrong. I think sometimes he ought to punish.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. It does make sense.
No.
I've got two kids of mine, too.
Yeah. Now, I do think that there is a sense in which some people bear a burden of anger and hostility towards someone else who's wronged them. And even though that person who's wronged them does not come forward and ask for forgiveness, I think it's appropriate and good and healthy sometimes for people to release that burden, to let that go. Sometimes people call that forgiving them. But you got to let it go. If you are harboring this anger and hostility towards someone who's wronged you, this just eats away. It does you more damage than them. One speaker once said he was talking about being mad at his wife. And he would just, he said, you know, he'd turn over in bed and hug the wall, you know, and hang on the edge of the bed and punish her, you know. And after doing that for a couple of nights, he said, boy, I'm punishing her and I suddenly realize I'm doing all the suffering. And that's true. You know, sometimes we try to punish people by our ill will towards them for something wrong that they've done, and we just punish ourselves. We do all the suffering. So I think that may be a little different category than what the Bible is talking about for forgiveness, but I think this is part of what it's discussing when it talks about our attitude towards others. So I'm going to offer a qualified answer, then I'm going to have to run, and that being that I think biblically, forgiveness, releasing somebody from the punishment that is due them for the crime that they've committed against someone else is conditioned on asking for forgiveness. And this is the way God deals with it, and Jesus makes this statement sometimes, although sometimes he doesn't include that. It seems we have to take all of these into consideration when we're making our balanced assessment of this. And I think sometimes even when people don't ask us for forgiveness, if we are holding a grudge towards them, it's better for us to release it because it's hurting us more than it is hurting them by holding that grudge. And I think Jesus speaks to that as well. Now, I've written a piece about this that you can find on our website, Peter. It's called The Sin of Forgiveness.
Okay.
And there you'll get some thoughts that I have on it. You can refer to that at str.org. I hope that helps a bit.
Yes, it does, Greg. Thanks very much.
All the best to you, Peter.
You too. Bye-bye.
Thanks for the call. It's nice to hear from the UK. All right, I'll be back in just a moment. 1-800-227-5278. Open lines there. And in the 714 area code 754-4150 for Greg Kokel and Stan to Reason.
Hi, this is Hugh Hewitt. Want to make a difference for a Christianity worth thinking about? Stand to Reason can help you do just that. STR trains Christians just like you to be effective ambassadors for Jesus Christ. Stand to Reason relies on the support of listeners to continue broadcasting in your area and on the web. Your gift keeps STR providing training to you and other Christians to become effective ambassadors for Jesus Christ. You will learn how to deliver a message that is accurately informed, develop a method that is skillful, tactical, and fair, and cultivate a manner that is warm, attractive, and inviting. If you want to make a difference for Christianity worth thinking about today, both in the world and in the church, consider supporting STR Radio today. You can start supporting STR today by calling 1-800-2-REASON or send your gift to 1438 East 33rd Street, Signal Hill, California, 90755. Again, 1438 East 33rd Street, Signal Hill, California, 90755. And thank you for listening.
Looking for reliable information on current issues like same-sex marriage or embryonic stem cell research, or you just in need of some clear thinking on something that has you confused? This is Greg Kokel with a suggestion about a quick way to get the knowledge you're searching for right now. Before you search the web, log on to str.org. You'll find sound analysis, careful commentary on the issues that challenge you as a Christian thinker, issues right out of the headlines, issues on the top of the list in public debate. Take a few moments to browse. Topics range from ethical issues like partial birth abortion to the theological debate about faith and works and everything in between. From our radio archives to advanced online training to our speakers, bios, and schedules, you'll find it easy to get the answers you're looking for. You'll come away from str.org with the accurately informed mind of a good ambassador for Christ. You'll also learn the tactics to help persuade others of the truth behind your convictions. And don't leave without registering as an ambassador. It's free, and it gives you complete access to everything on the site. I'm convinced that your visit to str.org will equip you, challenge you, and help you to take a stand for truth. Try it today. That's str.org. Greg Kokel back here at Stand to Reason, giving you a piece of my mind today. You know, we got to shorten up on that lead there, on that music. Cut that little, whatever that is, out of there and get the action right there at the beginning. Just a further thought about this forgiveness issue before I go on to Hugh and then to Adam. Hugh in Irvine, California. Adam in Australia. Looking forward to talking to him. We're kind of bouncing around the Commonwealth here from the U.K., to Australia. You know, we just knew New Zealand and Canada and Scotland, and we'll kind of cover all the bases here. But keep in mind that this thing about forgiveness, I think sometimes forgiveness is tossed around too easily by followers of Christ because they know Jesus talks about forgiveness, and forgiveness is important. But as we said, he's predicated forgiveness on repentance. Further, forgiveness can only be given by the person or persons who are offended or injured. Let me say that again. Forgiveness can only be given by the ones who are injured by the crime in question. If you're not injured by the crime, you have no authority to forgive. You have nothing to forgive, quite frankly. This reminds me of, do you remember, was it now about 8 or 9 years ago, they had this terrible event in the Central Park in New York City, called this wilding thing? Remember when a bunch of guys went out and sexually assaulted a woman? And a number of them were caught, and the local priest or bishop or cardinal or somebody notable goes into the jail and says, "I forgive you." By what authority? Now, this angered a lot of people, by the way. Here these people were let off the hook entirely by this man of the cloth. On what grounds? He couldn't forgive for himself. He wasn't harmed by this. He was an outsider. He couldn't forgive for God because God's requirements are repentance, a turning back to God, an asking for the forgiveness. No, it's just like a blank slate. And that's a big mistake. So keep that in mind. Now, sometimes there are more people harmed than the direct victims. I mean, if the woman was molested, her family was harmed. And so there's a crime to them, her husband, her children, her friends who are deeply anguished as a result, who are injured in identification with what happened to their friends. So they're, the circle of those harmed is large. And by the way, this the Jews understood this because that's why they got so bugged in Mark chapter 2 when Jesus said to the paralytic, your sins are forgiven. Because they said, who can forgive sins but God alone? Why'd they say that? Because God is the one that's the chief one offended by sin. And so Jesus, what appeared to be a mere man to them, could not have the authority to forgive sins. Of course, he says, in order that you know that I have the authority to forgive sins, I say to you, get up and walk. He healed him. He did a miracle to show that he did have that authority. But how could he have the authority if he didn't have the, he wasn't the one offended? So this was an implicit claim to deity in that circumstance. Something to keep in mind. Back to the phones, and in Irvine, Hugh, welcome to Stand to Reason. Glad you called.
Thanks a lot. My question is, and I'm drawing from Leviticus 23:22 as I ask this, but as Christians, what should our perspective be on the role of government when it comes to individuals being generous with our wealth, when it comes to the poor and needy?
All right. This is an important question, because you asked me as a Christian, that is from the perspective of my understanding of the Christian worldview, that which is taught in the Bible and by Jesus. Who is Leviticus? I'm turning to this right now, but just FYI.
I'll tell you that, I mean, there's a lot of them in Leviticus, but it says, when you reap the harvest of your land, moreover, you shall not reap to the very corners of your field, nor gather the gleaning of your harvest. You are to leave them for the needy and the alien. I am the Lord your God. And
right, okay.
Other verses like that.
Okay, good. Now, here's the question. There are a couple of things going on here. This is very important because there's a hermeneutical consideration here. And I think a whole lot of people get these kinds of this wrong. On this issue, they get this concern wrong. To whom was God writing, giving this command?
The Israelites.
The Israelites. Okay. So what we have here is a law of the land for the Israelites under their system of government. What was that government? What kind of system of government was that?
I don't know.
Okay. It's called a theocracy. I'm sorry. I don't mean to trap you. I was just kind of making conversation. It's called a theocracy. Okay. Sorry. I'm sure you knew that, but you didn't think of it. It's a theocracy. A theocracy is where God rules his people directly, and he gives the rules by which he will rule them. So in this case, you have no separation of church and state, kind of. You have a theological country in which God directs them. Now, do we learn something about God's heart from this?
Yeah.
Yes, we do. God cares about the poor, okay? What are the obligations that human beings have then, or you asked me as a Christian, with regards to the poor? I think God cares about the poor, and he thinks human beings ought to care about the poor too. Here, it was a government law. Now, how does that compare to the government laws now? Do you think that God's laws in this passage in Leviticus and a whole bunch of other passages, which includes more laws than just this one, this is a politically correct one, but let me give you a politically incorrect one. He also said that homosexuals should be executed. Okay.
Right.
So do you think that God intends those laws to be just taken straight away and applied in our culture under Gentile systems?
No,
neither do I. And so when somebody takes this particular application, I know you're not doing it, but others do that, and they say, okay, see, God wants the government now to redistribute wealth and give it to the poor, they are not following the dictates of this passage. By the way, it doesn't say that it should read. In this case, there's no redistribution of wealth here. What there is an opportunity for people to scavenge. That's what this is, by the way, scavenging.
Right.
And therefore, the people who are benefiting, are only benefiting insofar as they put themselves out and do some work to get what they get. They're not getting anything free. And there is no government redistribution of wealth in this plan that you just described. What it shows is God's heart for the poor, and that we should try to make provisions so that even the poor can take care of themselves. That would be the principle that comes out of this. But to argue that the...
Sorry.
I was just going to finish up. To argue that this requires then that governments tax citizens to give to the poor, that is not following this example. Because there is no evidence in any of the law that God intends all Gentile governments to follow this particular thing. And even when Gentile governments try to do so, they aren't following this. They're doing something else. It's a redistribution of wealth. So I think the obligation in the New Testament is to God's people, not to governments. It's to God's people to share and to give. And so I do not think it's appropriate. It's a biblical mandate for the United States government, federal, state, local, whatever, to take your money and give it to me if somebody thinks that I'm poor. And that's somehow fulfilling our Christian obligation. There's a difference between taxation and redistribution of wealth on the one hand and charity on the other. Charity is something freely given. That's what's encouraged in the New Testament, not a government redistribution of wealth.
Excellent. Just one more follow-up question. Do you think Jesus or, well, God would cares more about people feeding the needy and the widow, the alien, over trying to get them out of their state? So, like, you know, do you think he would care more about us taking care of them and not so much about trying to get them to evolve past the welfare system?
Well, you know, this to me is very easy. You know, if you teach a man, if you give a man a fish, you feed him for a day. If you teach him to fish, you feed him for a lifetime. Now, do you think Jesus would like to have people fed for a day or for a lifetime?
Lifetime.
That's easy. That's simple. That's straightforward. And so we have to ask ourselves the question, not do we have an obligation to the poor? Yes, we do. But as if we're asking from a policy perspective as a government, how can we best do good to our people in need? Giving them something for free, asking nothing in return. Is this good for them? Well, it maybe makes us feel better in the moment, but if we give them without asking anything in return, it usually harms them in the long run. So we are not doing something good for the poor in those circumstances. It would probably be better for us to try to teach them the fish than to give them a fish and give our efforts there. That would be kinder and gentler, it seems to me, in the long run. What do you think?
Thank you very much, Greg. Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, okay. I appreciate the call.
You bet. Take care.
Yeah, thank you, Hugh. And you know what? This is the problem here, and I know a lot of Christians are well-meaning about this. When they look at the text, they say, see, the government, this is the government. Yes, it's the government under a theocracy. The people in the government under the theocracy are the people of God. So God is giving directions to his people. In the New Testament, it happens the same way. He gives directions to his people. Who are his people in the New Testament? The church. So he's telling the church to take care of the poor. He is not legitimizing the actions of government who take from some and give to others, a forcible redistribution of wealth, and that's the answer to it. You know, I just read a thing by Tony Campolo not too long ago where he's really mad about us not following the gospel. And then he goes into all these government things, the way the government is not using its money properly. The gospel doesn't speak to the government. It speaks to individuals. And it's not charity when somebody puts a gun to your head and takes money out of your pocket and gives it to somebody else. That's not charity. Actually, what it does is it hurts charity. Do you remember the opening lines of the Christmas Carol? And Scrooge is asked to give money out of charity out of his pocket. And what does he say? Well, I gave it the office. The government who takes my money is already taking care of these kids. I no longer have an obligation. And that's what happens. So you learn from them. Hour number one down, hour number two just ahead on Stand to Reason. Stay tuned for more Clear Thinking Christianity. I'm Greg Kokel.
Are you talking to me?
All right, this is our second hour together, ladies and gentlemen, on Stand to Reason. I'm Greg Kokel, and thank you for the privilege of spending some time with you today. And, of course, it's my pleasure to talk with you about anything dealing with ethics, values, and religion here in this next hour, the second hour of our show. If you've just tuned in, this is Stand to Reason, of course, the marketplace of ideas, where issues of philosophy and religion are discussed right here in the public forum of talk radio. That means you can ask a question about the Bible or ethical issues or defending your faith if you're a follower of Christ or not. Theological issue. Give me a piece of your mind. That's the rule here at Stand to Reason. And, you know, I have some things to comment about, but we have a caller who's been waiting for a while from Australia. So I'm just going to jump in and chat with him. Adam, welcome to Stand to Reason.
G'day, Greg.
G'day, mate.
How's it going?
Good. You've called before, haven't you?
No.
Oh, you haven't. Okay. All your Aussie stuff sound alike to me. I don't know. Is that the same for Yanks, that the way we sound to you? I don't know.
Probably a little bit.
All right. Well, I'm glad you called.
We're a little bit more sensitized to a lot of America. We got a lot of American TV here. So.
Oh, I got you. Okay. Well, it's always great to talk to you guys because you sound so wonderful. You know, it's like you have a built-in advantage. If you were to come to the States, and I don't know if you are aware of this, but if you were to come to the States and, say, speak to an audience, you would have everybody in rapt attention because just your accent gets you so much, you know, mileage with audiences. So I don't know if it works that way in reverse when Yanks come out that way, but it's good to talk to you.
I've heard that Aussies have an accent which just seems to mesmerize, I think. Sometimes.
Yeah, well, even or British. I mean, a lot of the UK accents, and I know there are variations, but they do, mesmerize is a good way to put it. We just think it sounds so intelligent and so clever and so, gee, we ought to listen to what this person says because I know he gets it. He must have something important to say. So, all right, so now the ball's in your –
reading a bit too much into the accent.
Well, now you got to say something really important, Adam. So, all right, it's your turn.
Okay, I just wanted to start off by saying I just really appreciate your work there at STR. I agree with almost all you have to say.
Thank you. Well, you're a very bright guy then.
No worries. I've been having a email debate conversation with someone who I'd call you call a higher critic.
Uh-huh.
And we were having a debate, and he was bringing up some evidence about the Q document, and how he says that there's no claim of Jesus' divinity in the Q document and or anywhere else in the Bible. And I thought, well, not knowing exactly what was in the Q document, I'd try, well, surely there is claims to the divinity of Christ back in, and I brought up Isaiah 7:14.
Yeah.
And then he said, well, have you read that passage in the Empirical? It's not talking about the coming birth of Christ. Situation there in for Ahaz.
Yeah, did you say in the Empirical? What does that mean?
That's what he said. Oh, he used that word.
That's odd.
Really, but it sounded like I just read it as.
Let me offer
how it all flows together. It can't be talking about a future event. It's talking about the current situation.
Right. Okay. Let me offer a couple of thoughts here, and then I'll let you jump back in. Okay? Because there's a number of things going on here. First of all, just I don't know if you realize that, but there is no such document called the Q document. Did you know that?
I sort of thought that, but
yeah, there is no
topics I hadn't really dived into.
There is no document called the Q document, as far as we know. The Q is a shorthand for the German word Quell, Q-U-E-L-L, which means source. And people have posited the Q document or a source document of some kind that informed the writing of Luke and Matthew, because when you look at Luke and Matthew and Mark, Matthew, Mark, and Luke have a lot of stuff in common. This is why they're called the synoptic gospels, synoptic, the same look, same eye, synoptic. The synoptic gospels, they have a lot of stuff in common. So there is material that is common let me back up for a moment. There is material in Luke and in Matthew that is common to Mark. So since Mark, some argue, is the most primitive gospel, it looks like Luke and Matthew borrowed some from Mark, because the language and the wording is almost exactly the same. However, and that's, I mean, there's a legitimate debate about all of that, and that may be the case. It doesn't trouble me if they borrowed, but some people think that's a concern. There's a literary relationship between the three of them. However, there is also some material that is common to Luke and Matthew that you don't find in Mark. So the assumption is that Luke and Matthew had Mark as a resource, but there was another, here's our word, source that they were drawing from to put data into their documents, their gospels, that was common to Luke and Matthew, and that's why there are certain places that aren't in Mark that are agreement in Luke and Matthew. So they call this theoretical source Q, the Q document. Now, it could be a document proper. It could be just an oral tradition that there was a lot of training and teaching that was passed down, and people memorized it and passed it down, and they are drawing from that. That's certainly possible. And it might be that there is no Q of any kind, and that the men operated under the inspiration of the Spirit and gave the same things. They have many similarities because the same Spirit was behind it authoring it. That certainly is a theoretical possibility, though I'm sure your friend won't entertain that.
Yeah.
Okay. So you have to keep in mind the limitations of the source that he's referring to right now. Was there a Q document, or was there an extra source that might have been drawn upon by Matthew and Luke? Maybe. So what? Now, what he wants to say is there is nothing in Q that is the common sayings between Matthew and Luke, that indicate the deity of Christ.
Yep.
Now, I don't know if that's true, but even if it were, so what? Sometimes people who are untrained don't see the references to the deity of Christ. They see, for example, in the Gospel of Mark, Jesus keeps referring to himself as the Son of Man. They say, see, it wasn't the Son of God, it was the Son of Man. So, you know, the Gospels start out with a low Christology. Mark is first, and you got the Son of Man, and then it isn't until John writes, you know, 30 or 40 or 50 or 60 years later, and now all of a sudden Jesus is the Son of God. See the evolution of thinking, or so the saying goes. But actually, the Son of Man is a divine term that comes out of the book of Daniel that identifies Jesus' divine nature, not his human nature.
Yeah.
And this is obvious when you do a study on the term. The point I'm making is it may be that your friend is missing the terminology that the Jews at the time understood to be claims to divinity. You with me?
Yeah. He does come across as very well read, and like he's done like Bible college, seminary, and that. He was a minister.
Okay.
He did pastor for a time, and then...
Well, then he should be able to answer these questions.
Yeah.
Because even if it turns out that they're in the common sayings between Luke and Matthew, and you can find this, if you do an internet search, I bet you can find a document that shows the common sayings.
Yeah.
Let's just say he's right, that there is no suggestion in those common sayings, which our scholars refer to as Q, there's no suggestion of the deity of Christ. What follows from that? What can we conclude about the early church's understanding about the deity of Christ from that bit of information? Does that prove that the early church didn't actually teach such a thing? No, it doesn't prove that at all. In the earliest gospel in Mark, we have Son of Man references that even the most liberal scholars like the Jesus Seminar scholars consider authentic sayings of Jesus, which are that suggest his deity. So, you know, you can't, I mean, and there's no way you're going to slice and dice the gospel material to squeeze the deity of Christ out of it. It's just not going to happen.
Yeah.
Okay. So now you might say, well, okay, it says deity of Christ, but I don't believe that. Fine. But the fact that Q, if it is a fact, that Q has no reference to the deity of Christ doesn't mean anything.
Right.
It doesn't mean any. So what?
Yep.
That's like saying, you know, I don't want to go there. I'm trying to think of another illustration, but I think the point is pretty clear. It doesn't tell you anything about whether or not the early church believed it. By the way, extra biblical material demonstrates pretty clearly that the early church believed Jesus was God. And we find this in the writings of the early church fathers very early on. We see a high Christology. Listen, Paul says in the book of Romans, and you can point this out to your friend, The book of Romans is an uncontested Pauline epistle from the 50s. Now, when I say uncontested, I'm not saying that there isn't some screwball somewhere who will deny that Paul wrote it. But it is the consistent assertion of an admission of scholarship across the board, from the most conservative to the most liberal, that Paul wrote the book of Romans. Now, Paul died in 62 or 63 or 64, right in there in the Neronian persecution, probably 64, 65. But he died early in the big great scheme of things, and he wrote Romans. In the third verse of the first chapter, he identifies Jesus Christ as risen from the dead, and the resurrection of Christ himself proves that he was the Son of God, declared with power to be the Son of God, Jesus Christ risen from the dead through the resurrection. So there you have a very high Christology within 20 years of the death of Jesus.
Yeah.
So, I mean, Paul's claiming Jesus is the Son of God, and that means God.
Yeah.
Okay, now let's go to you. Does that make sense then? There are a lot of good arguments for the early belief that Jesus was the Son of God, and Q has nothing, it doesn't enter into it.
Yeah, we did sort of have a few debates across with using that kind of material, but he didn't seem to, buy the kind of evidence I was putting forward.
Well, the question is, why wouldn't he? We have four accounts, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. They're independent accounts, and we also have the writings of Paul. And they're easier to date in some ways. We know they're early in the history of the church.
He has his doubts, and I think he would like to have had a lot more evidence, I guess.
Okay, well,
I'm not too sure of his thinking.
Okay, well, it's hard. I don't know how to deal with every one of them, but there you go. I mean, you have that Jesus claimed to be the Son of God, you know, and claimed divinity for himself, that the early church Christians believed this. I mean, the ichthus. You know what an ichthus is?
No.
Ichthus is the sign of the fish that has that Greek word that spells fish in Greek in the middle of it. It looks like an I and an X and then a theta and then a Y and an E. You've seen the symbol of the fish for Christians, right?
Yeah.
Well, sometimes the symbol has the word fish in Greek on the inside of it, but it's in Greek letters. That's an ancient Christian symbol. It goes back to the early second century. And that symbol, you can read about it in my piece on the Da Vinci Code, which you can find on our website. And I talk about this.
Okay.
And this thing, this is an acronym. It's the word fish, but every letter, there are five letters in the Greek word fish, which is ichthus. And every letter stands for something else about Jesus. And here's what it stands for. Jesus Christ, Christos, God's Son, Savior.
Yep.
Jesus Christ, God's Son, Savior. That means the early Christians believed that Jesus was the Messiah and also God's Son, who was the Savior. And there it is right there in that ancient form. So now very quickly to Isaiah chapter 7. This is where the virgin shall give birth. There's no question that this passage refers to something that's happening right at that time. There's no question about that. Nobody denies that. The question is whether it also refers to something in the future. Because the
dualistic prophecy.
Pardon me?
Like a dualistic prophecy.
Exactly right.
Right.
Now, the word there for a maiden, or that's translated virgin, is the Hebrew word alma, which could mean a young maiden. Now, keep in mind that these aren't exclusive. It's not either a virgin or a young maiden, because young maidens were virgins.
Yeah.
You know, so it could be either, you know, and it certainly doesn't seem to be the virgin there. I mean, I'm not sure. You certainly don't have a virgin birth there in the historical context that's being described there. But I'll tell you what's interesting is the New Testament authors understood this to be a prophecy of Jesus and tied it in there. And if you look in the Septuagint, the Greek word there that's used to describe this, and this is before the birth of Jesus, the Septuagint, the Greek translation of the Old Testament, was written. They use the word Parthenos, and Parthenos means virgin. It's not ambiguous as to what it means. Now, so I think that you can make a case for this being virgin, and that's what the Jews understood it to mean, and it was a prophecy about the Messiah to be born of a virgin, but I would never use Isaiah 7:14 to convince somebody outside of the camp of that.
Right.
Because they're going to see what your friend saw, and they're not going to buy it.
Right.
And so part of my confidence comes because the New Testament authors saw this as such, and I think that they were inspired by the Holy Spirit.
Okay.
I would rather use some other text from the Old Testament about Jesus, Isaiah 53, for example, which is about Jesus suffering and dying. But that is clearly about Jesus, I think much more demonstrably about Jesus, but it's not a deity of Christ passage.
Right.
So I just think you chose the wrong passage from the Old Testament to make the case about the deity of Christ. There are other ways you could argue from the Old Testament, but that's a little bit more difficult. I think it's better to argue from the canonical Gospels. That's the best historical material we have from the time, and I think that all of those people who wrote thought Jesus was God.
I just thought they will call him Emmanuel was a fairly strong argument.
Well, that's God with us.
Meaning of Emmanuel.
You shall call him Emmanuel, God with us. But remember, in the Old Testament, people, the word, I think, Yeshua or Joshua means God saves. So Joshua in the Old Testament, the book of Judges, you know, and then, you know, back there in the Exodus, that man Joshua is named God saves, but we don't assume that he's God.
Right.
So I think Emmanuel is suggestive of God's divine origins, but you have to Jesus' divine origins, but you have to have more to kind of make your case. Now, when you put, you know, Emmanuel together with a whole bunch of other things about Jesus, then it becomes evident that they don't just mean Emmanuel, God with us, in kind of a general sense, but they mean that this was God with us. Remember, it says. In later on in Isaiah, it says, "You shall call him Wonderful Counselor, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace, Almighty God." There, I think it's that's more powerful.
Okay.
In fact, the Everlasting Father is a mistranslation. It's really Father of Eternity. So Jesus isn't the Father, but he's all those other things, and I think that moves us closer. But again, I don't think that's all by itself going to make the case.
Right.
All righty?
All right. No worries.
Well, we got a nice long chat here with our friend from Australia.
Yeah, appreciate that.
Yeah, appreciate your call, too, from down under. I was there a year and a half ago up in Toowoomba.
Okay. Are you coming back?
If I get asked, I will.
Okay.
We go where we're asked, and I might, I don't know if I have, I do I get an invitation for next January? Up to Australia? No, we went last time during your summer time, so we'll see what happens, but keep an eye on my schedule, and if I ever go down under, maybe we'll meet.
Great.
All the best to
you,
Adam.
Forward to it.
Okay, bye-bye.
Thank you.
That was a fun call. All right, got to go to break, and then we'll get more calls after this. I'm Greg Kokel.
Hi, this is Hugh Hewitt. Want to make a difference for a Christianity worth thinking about? Stand to Reason can help you do just that. STR trains Christians just like you to be effective ambassadors for Jesus Christ. Stand to Reason relies on the support of listeners to continue broadcasting in your area and on the web. Your gift keeps STR providing training to you and other Christians to become effective ambassadors for Jesus Christ. You will learn how to deliver a message that is accurately informed, develop a method that is skillful, tactical, and fair, and cultivate a manner that is warm, attractive, and inviting. If you want to make a difference for Christianity worth thinking about today, both in the world and in the church, consider supporting STR Radio today. You can start supporting STR today by calling 1-800-2-REASON or send your gift to 1438 East 33rd Street, Signal Hill, California, 90755. Again, 1438 East 33rd Street, Signal Hill, California, 90755. And thank you for listening.
Looking for reliable information on current issues like same-sex marriage or embryonic stem cell research? Or you just in need of some clear thinking on something that has you confused? This is Greg Kokel with a suggestion about a quick way to get the knowledge you're searching for right now. Before you search the web, log on to str.org. You'll find sound analysis, careful commentary on the issues that challenge you as a Christian thinker, issues right out of the headlines, issues on the top of the list in public debate. Take a few moments to browse. Topics range from ethical issues like partial birth abortion to the theological debate about faith and works and everything in between. From our radio archives to advanced online training to our speakers, bios, and schedules, you'll find it easy to get the answers you're looking for. You'll come away from str.org with the accurately informed mind of a good ambassador for Christ. You'll also learn the tactics to help persuade others of the truth behind your convictions. And don't leave without registering as an ambassador. It's free, and it gives you complete access to everything on the site. I'm convinced that your visit to str.org will equip you, challenge you, and help you to take a stand for truth. Try it today. That's str.org. Stand to Reason, ladies and gentlemen, demonstrating that Christianity can compete in the marketplace of ideas. Greg Kokel, your host, and my congratulations to Lynn Most from Midland, Michigan. Lynn, you're our Frapper winner for today, and we will be sending a free gift to you from Stand to Reason, probably a book on relativism, which I will sign for you personally. We drew Lynn's name out of all of those who have registered on the Frapper map as one of our radio listeners, especially those who are podcasters. If you want to register, just go to our website at str.org, and there's a little symbol for our podcast in the lower left-hand corner. Click that. Go to our podcast map. You can register on the map, put a pin in the map, show where you live and who you are, and it's from that larger community of people who have identified themselves as Stand to Reason listeners that we choose every week someone who can win a free prize. Lynn Most from Midland, Michigan is that person this time. Also, remember this weekend, Saturday night and Sunday morning, Saturday at 5 p.m., Sunday at 9 in the morning and 10:45, I'll be in San Clemente, California at Pacific Coast Church. I'll be talking about truth is not ice cream and faith is not wishing. Now, if you want more information there, the number is 949 area code 940-2600. That's 949-940-2600, or you can just go to our website and click my face and then look at my schedule, and you'll get the information there as well. Hope you can make it to the San Clemente area. Okay, back to the phones, and Brett, thank you for waiting. Spring Arbor, Michigan. Is that right? Hello, Brett. I need Brett here. I got him on my thing. Brett, are you there? Brett, number three. Oh, I'm sorry. That's my fault. Oh, my bad. Mea culpa, mea culpa. Okay, Brett, that's probably you.
Yeah, that is me.
I'm sorry.
No problem.
Okay. What's on your mind today, Brett? Thanks for calling.
No problem. I had two questions, and I just thought of a third. I said, if you have time for the two or three.
All right, well, give me your best shot first out of the gate, and then we'll see what we do with the rest. We got some other callers waiting.
Of course.
Okay.
The first question is, do we have biblical evidence that we do, as humans, have free will? Like, for instance, I mean, it's, you know, the pantheist world, you know, view is that it's all just a dream by God anyway.
Well, I don't know. The biblical teaching assumes that we are rational creatures who can engage the world around us. If you're comparing it to the pantheistic or the Hindu worldview, mm-hmm. That the scripture says, in the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. Mm-hmm. This is a very clear statement from the outset, from the get-go, out of the blocks, that God is different from that which he created.
Okay.
There he was, and then something new comes into being. And that new thing involves rational creatures who are capable of being in relationship with him. And if nothing's clear from the first couple of chapters of Genesis, it seems that is.
Okay.
And therefore, the biblical worldview would preclude anything like a Hindu worldview or a pantheistic worldview.
Okay, that makes sense.
Okay, now this doesn't prove that our view is right and theirs is wrong or vice versa. It just shows that they're very different and you can't bring the two together.
Right. That makes sense. Okay.
Okay, if that was the first question, then we got time for another one.
Okay, the second question then is the Calvinist-Arminian debate, or Calvinism-Arminian debate, my question is kind of, does it really matter? I mean, you know, it's one of those situations, it is what it is. Does it matter whether we know we're elected or not? Or
well, let me just go back to your comment. You said, well, it is what it is. Does it really matter? Well, just because it is what it is doesn't tell you that it doesn't really matter. Jesus either is or isn't the Messiah, but does the question matter? Yeah, it matters a lot. So that's not the rationale you want to go by.
Okay.
You want to. Some things seem to matter more than others. Some things seem not to matter hardly at all, so we shouldn't get in a big fuss about it.
Okay.
When you consider the issues at stake in the discussion, and this has to do with principally the discussion about Calvinism and Arminianism is about one issue. Broadly put, what is that issue?
It's free will, predestination.
Yeah, regarding what? Pertaining to what?
Salvation.
Salvation. Okay, so this is about salvation. Is that an important one?
I would assume so, yeah.
Pretty big, yeah. I think it is. And so the questions that pertain to the nature of salvation are the biggest kinds of questions. This question came up a couple of weeks ago, and I kind of gave it the short shrift, and I felt bad about it afterwards because I thought, well, maybe – I think the impression my listeners got was that I didn't think it was that big of a deal. I actually do think it's a big deal, mm-hmm. but it's not decisive with regards to your faith. You can be an Arminian and a Christian and a Calvinist and a Christian regardless of what view is correct. But what it does do is it focuses in on the nature of salvation. And I think it's fair to say what makes the difference in the long run? What makes the difference in the long run with regards to salvation? Is it my free will? And here I'm using the word free will in a very particular way. That is it my unencumbered or uninfluenced, or maybe I could use this word, and it's the technical term, my libertarian free will. That is it my choice? When I could do one or the other, I could have done otherwise. I had freedom to do it or not to do it. I had the power to accomplish this or to do something else. Is it when push comes to shove, is it up to me? Or when push comes to shove, is my salvation up to God? That's the question. And when I put it that way, does it sound important or not?
It does sound important, yeah.
Yeah, I think it is. And I think it influences a lot of other things in our lives. Though I have friends that, now I'm Calvinist, so I think when push comes to shove, it's up to God. God does it. God secures it. God makes it happen. God makes it happen. He guarantees it. He keeps it. All of those things. God is the author and finisher of salvation. Now, I have dear friends who think I'm dead wrong on this, and they hold a completely opposite view. And they are not only dear friends, but they're very godly people. So I don't mean to suggest at all that you can't hold an opposite view and not be godly. But I do think that on balance, that it does make a difference on how you live your life and how you understand God. I think it is more – this is my take now, but I think it's more – oh, what's the right word now – It's more theocentric, the Calvinist view.
I see.
And therefore more God-honoring. That's not why I choose it. I choose it because I think the Bible teaches it.
I agree.
But I think it has this other impact.
The question, I guess, is in terms of how we live our lives, see, it would seem that in both views we're called to witness the same way.
Yes, but the real issue has to do with the God's issue of the issue of sovereignty and control.
Okay.
And I want to be careful here because, in a way, I hesitate saying that those who are Calvinists have a stronger commitment to the sovereignty of God,
mm-hmm.
because I know Arminian friends would say they have a very robust commitment to such sovereignty. But I think the way it cashes out in the way that it characterizes sovereignty. It just seems to me that there is a stronger commitment to sovereignty. I think God is more central in the Calvinist view,
right.
And so, you know, again, ultimately it's the textual evidence that makes the difference. But I think it tells whether the view is true or false. But I think that for me, as a Calvinist, because of my trust in the sovereignty of God, it influences dozens of different things in my life. That's an understatement. All kinds of things in my life.
I understand.
And so ultimately I have a deep confidence that God can accomplish his purposes in spite of me.
So it's a whole worldview thing then.
I think so. And again, it's not to suggest that there aren't Arminians who have a very robust understanding of the sovereignty of God, but I think on balance, the Calvinist view emphasizes that more. And therefore, it has a different kind of impact in people's lives.
All right.
I also know for myself mm-hmm. that I am not responsible for my salvation, and it's a good thing because if I were, I'd mess it up. I mean, that my confidence is in Christ entirely.
That's a very good point.
So, okay, Brett.
Okay.
Appreciate the call.
All right. Thank you.
Bye bye. Spring Arbor, Michigan. That's where all that big book place is down there. All right. Let's go back. And that opens a line, 1-800-227-5278. And now to Denver, Colorado, and Chris. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Greg. How are you today?
Good, sir.
That's good. Hey, I listen to you all the time, and I enjoy, I study on your site and stuff like that.
Good.
But I don't know. I'm trying to become a conservative.
It's hard, I know. It's an uphill battle.
It is. It's hard. I'm on disability, and my comment to the lady that answered the phone is if I had to depend on Christians to help me now, I think I'd starve to death.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm very grateful that the government gives me money each
right.
month
to
survive. And,
mm-hmm.
and I mean, I live a decent life, even though I'm on disability. I probably live better than many people in many countries,
mm-hmm.
even though I'm on disability. And I don't know if that's fair or not, but it's probably reality.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Well, a couple of thoughts real quickly. To be a conservative doesn't mean that you're against any government funding for anything like you're facing right now. The issue at first, out of the gates, is a philosophical discussion.
Yeah.
Some people think that the government has an obligation to redistribute wealth to those that some people think are less capable of taking care of themselves. And at the heart of that is an idea that that the government owns the money and that people don't own their own wealth, but it really belongs to the state, and the state then is free to distribute it. And here's the criterion: from each according to his ability, and to each according to his need. You have a need, you get what you need. This guy's got extra, we can take it.
Yeah.
Okay, now that's a Marxist doctrine.
I remember hearing that from...
Of course, Das Kapital or something.
Right.
Now that's a Marxist doctrine. And so in principle, because we believe in private property, and that when people labor, they ought to get everything that is the appropriate fruit of their labors, even if somebody else thinks it's more than they need. It's not their decision to make. It's our decision to make how we distribute it. So you have to start from a basic point of view and work from there. So I'm going to say, as a conservative, it's not their money, it's my money. And just because they have the power to do it doesn't mean that it's right and okay for them to take whatever they want and redistribute it.
Well, I don't believe
and keep it. No, okay. So I'm giving you the conservative take on this.
Yeah.
All right. So secondly, it may not be the case in your situation that if it was up to charity groups to take care of you, that you wouldn't be taken care of. Maybe that's true under the present set of circumstances when the government has already co-opted so much of that effort and made it a lot harder for people then to help the charity groups that would have done that if the government wasn't around. But there was a time when it was the church that was doing this and doing quite well at it. Okay, so that's just another thing to keep in mind. The third thing is that I don't think it's fair to assess the legitimacy of a policy based on how any one individual might fare under their policy, you in this particular case. We have to ask the question, what is going to do the greatest good for the greatest number? Mm-hmm. The fact is, when the government redistributes the wealth, it keeps a whole bunch of it in the process.
Yeah.
You know, they take with the right hand and give back with the left hand, but it's always a lot less that gives out with the left than they took in the right, because you got to feed the machine.
Yeah.
I was just talking at the last break with the enforcer about an organization that I think is still running in this area called the Orange County Rescue Mission. When I was actually working for the Crawford Broadcasting Company years ago, sitting right in the same chair, but working for them instead of working for Stand to Reason, this Orange County Rescue Mission was considering sponsoring my radio show, and so I went out to see their facility. I was amazed at what they accomplished with so little. And if memory serves me correctly, as I went through this amazing facility, people come off the street, they get a haircut and a shave and a bundle of clothes and a bed and 3 squares a day and training and all this other stuff. And there's a limit. They could be there for like a month, and unless you've got a job and you're waiting for your next paycheck, and then they'd extend it for another couple weeks, but they try to help you get a job. I was amazed at what it cost them to do that. It was something like $3 a day per person.
Well, and I've learned to live on very little.
Well, the point that I'm making, though, is that if people were allowed to give their money instead of the government to charitable organizations, the charitable organizations would make that money go much, 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 much farther than it's going right now with the government doing the distribution.
Well, I understand what you're saying. And when God's brought in, you can do almost anything.
That's true.
You know, I mean.
So the question you want to ask yourself, though, Chris,
brought in, but,
it's Chris, right?
Yes.
Chris, the question you want to ask yourself as a citizen, and sometimes this is hard to ask it this way, as a citizen, is not to say what system helps me better right this moment, but rather ask the question, what system is best for the common good? That's the appropriate question for a citizen to ask. I understand, like, you know, you got it pretty good right now, and you don't want to change it. I fully understand that. But as a voter and a citizen, I think what we should be saying is which system works best for everybody, all things considered. And I think the government redistribution does not help. It hinders. It, when your government gives you a check, you feel entitled. You don't feel like, hey, thanks a lot. Somebody sacrificed on my behalf. Who can I say thanks to? You see the difference there?
Yeah, I do. And there was a time where I considered God as my employer when I went on disability.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, I do.
And then the checks stopped coming in. God didn't sign the checks is what you're thinking, right?
No, the government did, but the government doesn't save me. And you know
that's
that.
Right. Sure.
They do.
Sure.
And, you know, when I look at God as my employer, all these opportunities to be God's employee come up in my life.
Yeah.
And I do a lot of volunteer work.
Good.
Which is good. And I can also do a little work. I can do a little work. I don't make a lot of money, but they let me make a little bit of money. And being on disability.
Right.
And so I can do that too.
Well, mostly what I got to run to another caller here, Chris, but mostly what I wanted to do was to try to lay out, in a sense, in principle, what conservatives care about and not look so much at the micro in your circumstance, but the macro and say what's best for all of us. And I don't know if I brought you closer to becoming a better conservative or made it more difficult, but I hope I moved you in the right direction. So thank you so much for the call, Chris. Let's go to go to break. Got flagged down by the enforcer there. Okay, we're going to break, and after that we're going to Stephen in Japan and then in Robin, Charlotte, North Carolina. Boy, this is the international day, isn't it? Okay, glad to see that. Greg Kokel, Stand to Reason.
Hi, this is Hugh Hewitt. Want to make a difference for a Christianity worth thinking about? Stand to Reason can help you do just that. STR trains Christians just like you to be effective ambassadors for Jesus Christ. Stand to Reason relies on the support of listeners to continue broadcasting in your area and on the web. Your gift keeps STR providing training to you and other Christians to become effective ambassadors for Jesus Christ. You will learn how to deliver a message that is accurately informed, develop a method that is skillful, tactical, and fair, and cultivate a manner that is warm, attractive, and inviting. If you want to make a difference for Christianity worth thinking about today, both in the world and in the church, consider supporting STR Radio today. You can start supporting STR today by calling 1-800-2-REASON. Or send your gift to 1438 East 33rd Street, Signal Hill, California, 90755. Again, 1438 East 33rd Street, Signal Hill, California, 90755. And thank you for listening.
Looking for reliable information on current issues like same-sex marriage or embryonic stem cell research? Or you just in need of some clear thinking on something that has you confused? This is Greg Kokel with a suggestion about a quick way to get the knowledge you're searching for right now. Before you search the web, log on to str.org. You'll find sound analysis, careful commentary on the issues that challenge you as a Christian thinker, issues right out of the headlines, issues on the top of the list in public debate. Take a few moments to browse. Topics range from ethical issues like partial birth abortion to the theological debate about faith and works and everything in between. From our radio archives to advanced online training to our speakers, bios, and schedules, you'll find it easy to get the answers you're looking for. You'll come away from str.org with the accurately informed mind of a good ambassador for Christ. You'll also learn the tactics to help persuade others of the truth behind your convictions. And don't leave without registering as an ambassador. It's free, and it gives you complete access to everything on the site. I'm convinced that your visit to str.org will equip you, challenge you, and help you to take a stand for truth. Try it today. That's str.org. Greg Kokel back with you here at Stand to Reason. Your place for straightforward, no frills, nothing buttery, real, believable Christianity. Something you can sink your teeth into every weekend. Sundays, 3 until 5 here on AM 740 in Southern California. KBRT is our flagship station, has been for years and years. 17 now, going on 18 coming up. And, of course, many of you listen on our podcast, str.org. You can also listen to, I don't have the paper here, is it am740kbrt.com? They can go to the website of KBRT itself and listen live streaming. Listen, we have a part-time job available at Stand to Reason Proper. We're in Signal Hill, California, which for those who are not right in that area, it's basically Long Beach, right off the 405 freeway and the 710, that's the Long Beach freeway. So if you're within striking distance, especially if you're a student in the area, and you would like to consider working 20 hours a week for us to assemble product and pack products for events and that kind of stuff, why don't you send an email to Tina, our product manager, at tina@str.org. That's tina@str.org, and send a resume and your information to her, and she'll consider that. We're looking to fill that pretty soon, so give us a ring as soon as you like. Let's go to kbrt740.com. That's Dubs, kbrt740.com, if you want live streaming. Let's go to Japan and Stephen. Hello, Stephen.
Hello, Greg. How are you?
Fine. Are you a regular caller from Japan, or are you someone new?
Yeah, I guess I'm regular.
Good.
It's going to be my anniversary, first anniversary.
Well, this is our third country today on this show, in addition to many states. So we're truly cosmopolitan here at Stand to Reason.
Yeah, by the way, if you said you go wherever you're called, then why don't you make here?
I said wherever I'm invited.
Well, so, called or invited. You are invited, in fact.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's got to be more than that. I mean, it's got to be somebody that calls us up and say, you know, here's my church, my organization, my group. We'd like to invite you out, and here's how we'll arrange for you to get here. You know, it's that kind of thing.
Yeah, I can talk to my pastor, maybe.
Well, I'd love to do it. I would love to come out there if we can make an impact and make a contribution. So the enforcer who you just talked with, she's the one. So she handles all of that.
All right.
Thank you.
Anyhow, just a quick question for you. My Christian friend who recently became one asked me what can he do with his girlfriend that he loved, and they're actually committed to their relationship.
Mm-hmm.
He has have not enough money yet saved for the wedding, and also there are some other issues involved. So I was wondering is official marriage really necessary for Christians, and what would be the definition of marriage for you?
Well, okay, there's a couple things going on here, as often in questions like this. One of them is the definition of marriage. I just want to make a point clear that I hope a lot of people listen to this regarding the definition of marriage, because this is under challenge now in a way that you're not ringing it up. You're talking about heterosexual couple, but it is with homosexual couples a lot. There's the challenge here. Well, how do you define marriage? And the question itself is, I think, shows that somebody's off to the wrong foot. How do you define marriage, people might say. It's not quite the way you offered it, but and it suggests that marriage, first of all, is a matter of definition, and secondly, that different people define it different ways, and thirdly, that no definition is any better than any other definition. And I think that's a mistake from the get-go. The question is...
Right,
and this isn't so much for your benefit, because I think you're on the same track as this as I am, but I wanted to take an opportunity to speak to a larger audience on this, and that is, you don't define marriage. What you do is you observe what marriage is and then describe it. You don't define marriage. You observe it and describe it. See, marriage is not something that's like a convention. You can do it any other way you want. Hey, I'm going to go and sit down and have a picnic in the park with myself, and I'm going to define that as marriage. Now, you can't just define marriage any way you want. What marriage is a it's a term that we use to describe a very unique relationship, which is the corner, which provides the cornerstone for culture. Marriage is the relationship that starts a family, and the family is the cornerstone or the building block of culture. Okay.
I guess I have a little bit different thing in mind. To me, marriage was always the condition of faith and loyalty rather than, you know, wedding dress and honeymoon, you know what I mean? It's a kind of a matter of...
Right, okay, well, I'm...
Moral definition.
No, I understand that. But let's just continue from what I was just offering, because I'm getting into your territory now. So what is the nature of that commitment between a man and a woman that provides, that starts a family, which is the foundation for culture. Well, generally, it is a commitment between a man and a woman of a very unique kind. That is a long-term commitment.
Sure.
And it is something that, because the culture cares about it maintaining its long-term quality, and the principal reason for that is because heterosexual relationships, by nature, as a rule, as a group, produce the next generation, then we as a culture are concerned that that next generation is properly cared for. And since it takes a long time to raise a generation, like 20 years, and getting longer now, used to be only about 13. Now it takes 20, 25 years to raise a kid. Who knows why that is? But in any event, then it's important for the culture to encourage that, the stability of that relationship. And therefore, when people make this decision, the culture puts appropriate pressure to make sure that that decision to stay together, which decision can produce children, is a durable one. And that's why the custom in all cultures is to celebrate that publicly and to give a commitment before a group of people. So there is a kind of a there's a kind of an implicit pact with the community regarding that relationship. Okay? So when people get married, it isn't just a matter of, well, two people love each other, and so it doesn't matter what other people say, we have our love. It does matter. Because if what you're doing is forming a long-term relationship that might produce children, then the community wants to encourage the longevity of that as much as possible. And so if your friends say, okay, well, we really love each other, and before God, we're okay, because that's really what matters, my response is, no, God cares about the long-term nature of that. And you're saying, yeah, well, we're going to have a long – it's going to be long-term. We that's our desire. All right, then make that long-term commitment in front of a group of people. And have the community officially sanction it so that it builds it that way. Then you're accountable. Does that make sense?
Which is called wedding, by the way, right?
That's called a wedding. That's right. And a marriage license, too, that the government goes further by licensing the relationship. And so there's more stability that's built into that relationship in that way. So, you know, I'm always suspicious of people. And I know your friends probably are good-hearted, but I'm suspicious of this. Yes, we love each other, and we don't have enough money, but so we're just going to live together.
I mean, there are some other issues involved, Greg. Like I said, you know, her family is not Christian, and it probably won't accept him as easily as, you know, probably other family would. So there are some, you know.
Oh, well, okay. So then I guess I'm not sure what decision's at stake. Usually the decision's at stake here is, well, we can't get married, but we really love each other, and we're as good as married, so we're going to sleep together. And does God mind? And that's the issue. Or we're going to live together. Well, I don't know if the people – go ahead.
That's the issue.
Well, if they live together, that's just as bad with regards to the families, it seems to me. And if they live together, I don't know why they can't get married. I mean, because what is the – we don't have enough money to get married, but we have enough money to live together. How does it cost any more to get married?
But I mean, like I said, Greg, her family is not, as far as I know, her family is not Christian, and they probably won't accept the guy as easily.
Okay, but how would they accept him? I guess I'm confused. How would they accept him if they're living together? I don't see how that. You know, they're not going to accept him either way, whether they live together or not. So I guess I'm not clear.
Greg, you know, wedding is a little different. You know, you got to invite a bunch of people. You know, stuff like that.
So the parents would say, and I just tell me if I'm mistaken in here, the parents would say, well, we're not hot about the guy that you chose, but as
right.
long as you don't marry him and you just live together, then we don't have to kind of let everybody, our friends know that you chose this guy. Is that kind of what's going on?
Well, you know, maybe that, or, you know, that's what he said, you know.
Well, I don't know.
My fiance's parents are not Christian.
Well, I guess I just don't see how that makes a difference. Maybe then they won't want to sponsor a big wedding. Well, then they go it alone. There are parents who either won't or can't pay for a wedding, and so then the couple decides to, you know, to do what they can. And then they make it the best they can. Maybe they get married in a park and invite their friends, and they have Kool-Aid and crackers instead of a big banquet dinner. But I think they can still celebrate in a way that's consistent with their means. I wouldn't want to give sanction to two Christians not getting married but pretending like they are for any of the reasons that, well, for any reasons at all. I don't think it's honoring to God. And I think it's stronger and better for the kind of relationship that God wants to go through the, in a sense, socially accepted norm of celebrating as a group the commitment they're making to each other.
I guess the issue here is, that prohibited? Is that sin? That's what his concern is.
You mean they can't get married because their parents won't let them?
Well, yeah, basically.
Well, I guess I don't understand that. I'm lost. If they two people of age can always get married, it seems to me, though they may have to.
Well, you know, Greg,
endure some pressure.
Sometimes, like, you know, parents make decisions for kids when it comes to, you know, choosing partners and, you know, schools and jobs, whatever, you know.
Okay, well.
They're really not supposed to, but they really do.
Okay, I can see that. All right. Now, if it's the case that the parents are saying you can't get married, but you can live together.
Well, they're not saying that either, Greg, of course, but, you know.
If that would work. Well, I wouldn't live together because I would rather not act in such a way that it dishonors my parents. That's, I mean, my God. And so if it's not possible to do it any other way, then it isn't right to do it the wrong way.
I mean, if parents' desire is not based on any ethics at all, just, you know, prejudgment and basically.
Yeah. Well, that's the best I can do at this point, Steve. Okay. I've got to take – I got some other calls going, but –
All right. Thanks for your time, Greg.
Okay, appreciate the call. Let's talk to Rob in North Carolina. Rob, welcome to Stand to Reason. Hi.
Hey, Greg. Thanks.
Sure. We made it.
Yeah.
You made it.
I just wanted to say I appreciate your ministry very much. Long-time listener and supporter, and at least I buy your stuff. So.
Good. That's good.
I want to try to keep this really simple.
All right.
In light of world politics and such, and now I think we're coming on, it's, you know, midterm elections, certainly not voting on presidents, but...
Uh-huh. It's an important one, right.
Pardon me?
It's an important election.
Well, I think so.
Yeah. Balance of powers in question.
Yeah, very much so, the legislative. But in light of just even recently, Bush and Secretary Rice promoting additionally... the Mideast or Israel being divided up, or at least remaining to be divided up, and I mean, there's.
They are promoting the partitioning of Israel.
No. It's been already partitioned.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And it's certain. And
the Palestinian solution kind of thing.
Exactly.
Okay.
And in fact, even there was the last quartet, meaning Russia, the EU, and the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
President Bush, wanting. I think it was last year where the Gaza Strip was essentially...
Right. Given up.
Yep. Given
yeah.
up. And even Lebanon.
Mm-hmm.
My question is simply, knowing that, you know, I'm not a replacement theorist, of course,
mm-hmm.
otherwise I wouldn't be caring about this, but mm-hmm. I think that Israel should...
Replacement meaning you don't think that the church replaces Israel. They still have a role in God's economy.
Absolutely.
Right.
So I think also the land does as well.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
So... I know there's an ethical hierarchy, but I can't imagine voting for a president now with an understanding that he's promoting Israel to be divided up.
Okay, let me do the best that I can to respond to this, and I do think it's a tricky issue, and I'm not sure if I've got the right answers here. But in principle, I think it's a mistake to make political decisions based on policy decision, based on what one thinks God – what's the best way to put this? Look, I think that President Bush's responsibility and Condoleezza Rice's and the rest is to look at the political situation and act in a just fashion given all the factors they're faced with. I do not think that it would be appropriate for them to second-guess biblical prophecy or anything like that and say, well, look, at God gave – it's my belief that God gave Israel to the Jews, and therefore I have to act in this way right now. That is, I must oppose any kind of partitioning or giving any land away to anyone else. I don't think that's appropriate, and partly because if God gave the title deed of a certain amount of real estate to Israel, then it's God's job to get that to them in his good timing. It actually, Israel has never occupied the entire amount.
Well,
and some of it's in the hands of other countries right now.
There was the original mandate, and they did have certainly the Gaza Strip and far more.
Oh, no, more than they have now. I understand that. But see, the thing is, it is, oh gosh, there's the music. We're out of time. I would still vote for the president if I thought he was doing what was good, and just under the circumstances and the polity he's facing right now on an international basis. What I would not want him to do is say, I'm going to vote for all the land for Israel because I think God promised it. That's God's job to get it for Israel, and there are a lot of times when God partitioned that land to someone else for a period of time for his own purposes. I'm sorry you got the short shrift, Rob. It's best I can do now. Maybe we'll talk about it next week. Greg Kokel, Stand to Reason. Go out and give him heaven this week, my friends. Bye-bye.